Welcome once again to the Month 8 Investable ETO briefing. And the period we're covering today covers from the 1st of August to the 31st of August. As the briefing document explains, exchange-traded receivables are leases, monetary obligations, or bills issued under contract for assets, goods, and services supplied to investment-quality companies are credit-insured invoices from investment-grade insurers. It's all a bit of a mouthful, but what that means is that ETR is evidence of a debt owing from one company to another. Typically, these tend to be large companies or banks that are household names, and they owe money to their smaller micro to medium-sized suppliers. We call these micro to medium-sized supplier businesses originators because they originate the debt obligation. And these are the transactions that create ETR that are traded on the exchange. So the ETR is evidence of the large company's liability to the smaller one, and credit exchange buy these ETR at a nominal discount to their face value. In so doing, when the ETR is settled or paid in full, the difference between the face value that is settled and the discount that we purchased it for creates a margin, and it is that margin that creates the yield or return for the investors. So a credit exchange provides all types of different credit facilities to support other types of transactions like trade finance, asset finance, and other transactions. Essentially, they all work on the same principle that the traded ETR is a business transaction. And then the exchange provides the liquidity and is paid a commission for doing so, much in the same way a bank charges interest. So as the briefing document states, at the end of August, Credit Exchange held an active RSA of 19.71 million. And this is consistent with July's figure, albeit marginally down. As explained previously, RSA stands for Revolving Sale Agreement. And a revolving sale agreement is a document or a contract between the micro to medium-sized business or the originator and credit exchange. The revolving sale agreement is a commitment by the originator to sell a certain value of ETR to the exchange in any given period. Typically, that's for 1 year. So, for example, let's say an originator needs a revolving credit facility of $250,000 in order to run their business. They would come to us much in the same way they would go to a bank. They'd apply for that credit facility, and if we agreed to provide it, $250,000 on, let's say, a revolving basis of every 60 days, then they would be signing a revolving sale agreement or RSA agreement to sell us $250,000 worth of ETR every 60 days or $1.5 million worth of ETR every 12 months. So that commitment to sell us the 1.5 million of ETR annually is documented in their revolving sale agreement or RSA with the exchange. So as stated, at the end of August, the exchange held 19.71 of these active RSA contracts as at the 31st of August. Some of the members in the audience may recall that from the last three consecutive briefings, I've explained that there was a decline in the total value of RSA contracts owned by the exchange. This has been a combination of several months of trading that compounded in quarter two, and as stated, the decline had already turned to a sharp increase in June. Another reason is that strategically we've moved further into the trade finance arena, so the cash-to-cash cycle is shortening. In some cases, the cycle can be as short as 7 days and certainly less than 30 days. What I mean by cash to cash is how long it takes for a payment out to purchase an ETR or buy it versus how long it takes for that ETR to settle and come back into cash in full. As this briefing is about August trades, the continued positive increase in trading continues to perform almost set to the target that we set in January. So that target was that we wanted to trade 175 million, and best predictions are that we'll certainly at the 150 mark or higher. So insofar as COVID is a focal point for most sectors, its overall effect on the exchange is to the positive. By this, I mean, wherever the coronavirus has caused a downturn in trade, for example, from originators in the hospitality sectors, there's been an upturn in other markets like wholesale sector, where consumers are consuming more and traveling less. In addition, with caution, we've financed PPE, personal protection equipment transactions, or PPE, that have compensated also for any negativity in light trade from other sectors. On that note, in relation to COVID-19, Deloitte commented recently that they were surprised at how unaffected the exchange has been in the past 6 months. More's the point, I think they were impressed by the positive effect. On that note, although they're published considerably later than usual, those accounts for Credit Exchange can be downloaded from the CRO, or indeed Andrew will gladly send those to anyone that requests a copy. Moving back to the briefing, it then goes on to say that there was 24.5 million fully allocated. And this is slightly below July's figure of 25.4. What this fully allocated figure means is that on the 31st of August, the exchange held ETR valued at 24.5 million. Or said another way, there was 24.5 million of investors' funds in the market on the last day of August. When you add this to the 19.7 million, this represents the future orders on our books from the RSAs that we have filled. When you add the two of them together, you have a total of about 44.5 million, which again is in line with July or indeed June's numbers. Moving to the next figure, it states that investors redeemed roughly 750,000 of their funds in August, meaning that collectively a total of almost 30 investors withdrew 750,000 during last month. And at the same time, 1.1 million of new or additional funds were received from in around 20 different investors. A level of $250,000 withdrawals in August would be more typical of what is traditionally a summer month. But as we all know, 2020 has proven to follow everything but the norm. So withdrawals have largely leveled off, and overall investor inflows continue to outgrow withdrawals. So money in versus money out was roughly 3-2, and is a typical ratio for us over the last number of years. Again, as per previous briefings, the exchange has taken the corona shock in its stride and continues to demonstrate stability, liquidity and a real demand from the investor market it serves. Last month I talked about the consumption of high fashion consumer goods, luxury items, and such like purchases all being hallmarks of a booming economy, and how no matter how dark an economy gets, people still need to eat, sleep, work, pay for utilities and so on in order to exist, even in the most moderate of incomes, albeit this coronavirus and the recession or even depression that we're suffering at the moment has caused a slump in exchange trading by originators in those specific sectors, or more correctly, in some specific sectors. As I said a moment ago, this has been countered by a surge in a demand for PPE, things like visors, gloves, gowns, sanitizers, and the like. And as stated, those consumers that were spending their money on luxury are now saving and focusing on survival whilst saving, all the while Credit Exchange is quietly serving both sides of that market. With H1 well and truly behind us, we're back to business as usual in early quarter three. And August continued that trend. As stated over multiple briefings since May, the economic crisis has and is good for investable investors, which brings the focus of the presentation to the ETR average duration figure of 118 days on the top right of the document. For those of you unfamiliar with this number, we call that the credit index. This is an ETR average duration, or number of days it takes for an ETR to get settled. As I mentioned earlier, it's the cash to cash cycle from the day the ETR is issued and purchased using cash, and the number of days it takes for the debt to be extinguished or settled and the and is returned to cash. So in June, the credit index hit an all-time high of 134 days. And for those hard-pressed originators in the market, a drop back by 16 days is a welcome flow of faster settlements and increased cash flow. So although there's not a lot to celebrate when you compare 118 in August this year to 83 days in August 2019. So what that means is, on average, it took 83 days for ETR to settle in August last year, so roughly four times a year. And as has been the case for pretty much the majority of this year, at figures like 118 days, it means that ETR are settling roughly three times a year. So as explained in the past, in simple terms, that means that an originator requiring a revolving facility of 100,000 to run their business last year now needs a facility of 130,000 to 140,000 to run the exact same business this year. So that's another third more cash they need this year versus last year. What's bad for the originator means they need more funding. And that requirement comes from the exchange, and more investors' funds is needed to meet that demand. As we're starting to look towards the last third of the year, our forecast from January that predicted strong growth in the exchange's business, with no comprehension of the looming coronavirus, I might add, that prediction of strong and stable growth is been proven to be correct, irrespective of corona. On that note, where 2019 was a reset, regroup, and refocus for the company so that we could then move on for the development of the business in the future. So 2020, I think, has proven to be an interesting year insofar as its direction. What I mean by that is, just like every other business, the exchange has had to reevaluate its position and its direction to ensure that the originators it served of old will be part of its future. Last month, I mentioned the soundings that inflation is likely to become a real problem in the US and no doubt the EU economy. From a briefing from Bloomberg's Yelena Shulyateva and a chap called Andrew Husby yesterday, they went into greater depth about the impact inflation has already inflicted on investors, and how they're now looking at dates like 2024 before inflation will breach the important 2% threshold. So for pension holders in particular facing an excruciating 4 years of flat to negative yield, and then you add on top of this the recently introduced charge on bank deposits now running at 65 basis points. Noel pointed that out to us last month. It's a difficult time for investors. With the perspective like Bloomberg's Shulyateva and Husby looking at 2024 and even 2027 and talking about things like the Phillips curve, we're standing in a dark place as we all look towards quarter four. For those unfamiliar with that economic concept, the Phillips curve basically says that inflation brings employment and low to no inflation is a job killer. So that's why we in Credit Exchange have extended our market appetite by opening in England, as we did in quarter one of this year, and are currently engaged in negotiations in several continents during 2020, when in 2019 we were more than happy with just the EU and to much lesser extent the American market. So 2020, 2021, they'll see the international trade finance and other related trades contribute to a larger part of our annual revenue. So where inflation denies the market its requisite growth, we have proven so far to be adept at expanding our reach to counteract the scarcity of trade in our local market. Inflation, or the lack thereof, means we have to focus and continue to focus on those markets. And if Bloomberg's economists are to be believed, it's fortunate that our reset last year enabled us to focus our efforts in that direction this year, and it would seem for the next 4 to 5 years too. What continually shocks me is the seeming irreverence to the global drop in GDP across most economies. Drops of 5, 10, and 20%. And in the case of the US, as I mentioned, I think last month or the month before, they're talking about an annual drop of 30%. It doesn't really seem to have hit home yet. Hence to my comment earlier about a dark quarter four. So these are unheard of numbers. And yes, the airwaves seem to gloss over the issue, or if not to ignore it, in favor of COVID-19. So my personal views on that are for another day and another audience, but diversity is what we in Credit Exchange are doing, and I would say it's essential. So as Americans would say, we're on it, and things are good, thanks. Anyway, that's why we're referencing other indices and markets such as the Baltic Dry Index, or BDI. Again, for those unfamiliar in the audience with what BDI is, this is the index that tracks rates for shipping and of dry bulk commodities, is the index that we follow. When you consider that two-thirds of the world produce ends up on the high seas at some point, cargo movements are a good indicator of consumption, and consumption is fed by what we call originators. So for us as a trade credit organization, this barometer for trade activity and volume is an important reference point. Having recovered from one or two record lows in February and May of this year, the BDI index has been relatively stable the last 3 or 4 months. However, good as that might seem, its performance is just marginally ahead of what it was in the 1990s. So nonetheless, the market is fluid, and as German banks and Dutch investors pull back from the market, that's creating an appetite for new funding and even new types of funding, such as that at Credit Exchange. So I'm pretty bullish to the year end and into next year. Last month, I also talked about the large peak in trading and the all-time high in July of 37 million. Unfortunately, in August, we couldn't repeat that and came home at a healthy 13.24 million. I say healthy because this is still an average of 40% better than the numbers we had in 2018 and 2019. At yesterday's board meeting, it was noted that the exchange is still cautiously optimistic on reaching its target, both in terms of income and expenditure as budgeted at the start of the year. Moving back to the briefing specifically, below that last month's trading figure of 13.24, you'll see that in the same period, treasury performance was 12.74. So that means we spent just over 13 million and collected just under the same amount in August. So it's a good balance of inflow versus outflow, meaning trade purchases were only slightly ahead of trade settlements. As many of you in the audience already know, the trade desk and treasury monitor trade balance, so the fund in, funds in, funds out, to ensure that it remains stable and within the control parameters set down by our master risk policy. That master risk policy is the thing that governs the trade risk and the general exchange trading policies. So the imbalance caused by the surge in trade in July of the 37 million has returned back to an even flow. And the improvement in the credit index of 16 days or half a month was certainly a contributing factor in that leveling off. Moving to the center of the document, this is where we see the list of the 10 largest investable ETR holdings and the top-rated holdings. these two lists show that companies or organizations owe the largest amounts. The list on the left, I should say, are companies or organizations that owed the largest amounts of money to the exchange on the 31st of October, or sorry, of August. And as you can see, the HSE and Huawei continue to hold their slots for the sixth month in a row. We see Atradius and CBRE, Vodafone, Cork City Council was welcomed back in July and remains with us in August, as does Musgraves, who are also based in Cork. On the right-hand side are the highest rated debtors, and this list shows a random selection of organizations regardless of the amount of their liability. As with last month, as none of these were investment grade or have an investment grade rating at the end of August, this is simply a selection of the most creditworthy. Moving to the pie chart below these two sets of lists, there's the significant change in what it up until February was a well-diversified spread of ETR across the market. Since April and May of this year, the health pandemic continues to show that the HSE here in Ireland and the NHS in England, along with others in the health and community sectors, they're off their April high of 25% in our book, but they still remain pretty stuck at 13-14% mark. Looking to the last third of the year, we can see this rising again as originators for credit facilities in this sector are starting to emerge, both here, UK, and indeed America. It was expected that this month's August briefing would show a significant boost in trades in that sector, but our appetite for trade did not allow us to overshadow our risk appetite. So as of today, those trades remain possible, but only if the originators and debtors in both cases meet our strict trade and risk exposure parameters. When it comes to PPE equipment, it may be attractive, but it's also potentially risky because the manufacturers and indeed agents, they can often miss the mark in terms of quality and execution simply because they're trying to keep ahead of demand. Our risk parameters are carefully applied to remove any potential shortfalls in that area that could ultimately result in non-performance and non-payment. So we've done some good business in that sector, but cautiously. We have one particular actually transaction that we've been working on since the middle of August, but my view is that the US debtor won't meet our required needs and we'll probably decline to trade them. Anyway, the pie chart shows a heavy exposure on the wholesale retail market, and I'd stress that it's mostly wholesale more than retail. Obviously, high street retail has taken a severe hammering since February, and thankfully, we have no significant originators in that sector. Looking to wholesale, trade has been strong, has been as strong, I should say, as it has been brisk. During 2020, we've begun moving away from the current EU NACE categorization system, favoring our own credit classification system. Basically, for us, the NACE system was too finicky, too specific, and doesn't give a true reflection of our market. Ultimately, from a trade receivables risk perspective, we're more concerned with what we call the players in the trade, namely who's the originator, who's the debtor, what's the product, what's its primary and secondary market value, and ultimately what's a risk exposure in each trade. So the credit classification system is continued to be rolled out, and we're pretty much on target, assuming the IT guys do what they're supposed to do. We're hoping to finish that by the end of the year. Returning to the actual performance of the exchange in August of this year versus August 2019, you can see that the trading values are up almost another 100%, which continues the strong pullback to the positive from June, July. And as I mentioned earlier, the year's target income and budget for a growth of 75% remains a credible prediction for the year. I mentioned earlier about the credit index of 118 days, And next to that, you can see that we still have more than 6,100 creditors or debtors and creditors at month end in August. As per prior investor conference calls, relative to the number of trading companies in Ireland, this is a significant number and a statistically strong reference point when considering the Irish market. So this credit index is a strong indicator of how credit control and payment cycles are performing in Ireland at any moment. For any originator, improvement of 16 days in 2 months is going to be a welcome improvement. And to finish out the briefing, we will look at our performance in August. The largest single trade was just under 2.3 million. And as was the case in July, this happened to be on PPE equipment to the National Health Service, NHS, in the UK. As Andrew will tell you, the average value of an ETR is circa €2,000. But we've traded ETR where the value has been less than a euro. And as we can see here, last month, the largest single ETR was valued at 2.27 million. Our trade credit offerings, as you may well know, entered the market 4 years ago, back in 2016. So in a relatively short period of time, this has steadily grown to become a central offering in many of the credit facility deals we fund. So in 2018, it was more than 30% of our business. We like these trades because as the deal sizes grow, they often feature letters of credit, where ultimately our debtors are bank. And as explained in our last briefing, as we expand our market reach, we continue to see an increased use of letters of credit, or LCs as they're called. Albeit to date, 100% of our LCs have settled without waiver, without the need for a waiver. Statistically, they're not an easy instrument to work with. And more often than not, they do require waivers, which kind of undermine the integrity of the LC in the first place. Probably a bit optimistically, I suggested last month that we were looking at ways to develop our own equivalent to an LC, maybe using some kind of escrow or other trading type. But the further we looked into it over the last month or two, that was going to become no small challenge, and it could take months, if not years, to implement. So in the interim, we're going to stick with the LCs simply because it moves our risk away from debtors more to bank risk. And where I thought we'd be able to deliver on an alternative to LCs during 2020, I might have to concede that that was a little bit on the optimistic side. Let's watch the space. Our focus is, as it should be, on growing trade rather than creating financial instruments. We'll report on this as it develops. If it develops. Moving to the trends section of the briefing, which is the rounding out of the this presentation, we can see that the investors' yield or buy price during August averaged 1913 or 1.923%. This is slightly better than July's number, but so marginal it's not really noticeable. Despite our market bent, it has still not moved much. It's probably not fair to complain because in reality, market stability is good. And let's be honest, circa 2% versus negative 65 basis points in the bank. The investors almost 2.75% better off with investable than they are putting it in bank deposits. So respect where it's due. And to be clear, improving yield still remains a primary focus of what we do here. For the remainder of this year and on into next year. But it all boils down to originator supply. So subject to how successfully our expanded market reacts, this will largely drive that rate upwards. Given there's only 12 full trading weeks between now and Christmas, probably a bit optimistic to say that rate's going to be pushed through the 2% prior to the year end. But if our expansion into the wider market is successful, then yeah, I could see it next year. I thought it would happen this year, but it hasn't. Having said that, May started at a high of 1.877. We are now touching 1.923. Can we get it up to 1.97? Maybe. As you know, the rate changes daily. You can check that on the investable.com website homepage. Just to discuss trend in a little bit more detail, the graph on the right shows the movement during the month. And as the briefing states, we expect that the prevailing rate of 1.92% for the past year or so should turn and grow upward. We predicted it for this year. Well, let's see. So I remain optimistic, but can't commit at this moment. So in hindsight, we set out the year. We're currently delivering on that target. And as the briefing ends, you can see that we repeat the active RSA, or revolving sale agreement, at 19.17 or 71 million. Okay, that's it from me. Thank you very much.